I'm an alcoholic. My name's Kathy Burns. Thank you, Linda. You got me crying before I even got up here. And that's awesome. I'd like to thank the committee for asking me to come and share my story. I think it's an honor to be asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. To be able to participate in something like this is just phenomenal. I absolutely love coming and meeting new people. This is one of my least favorite things to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I kind of feel like I'm going to throw up, pass out, and use the bathroom all at the same time. And I know this will pass in about an hour, and if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, this too shall pass. Maybe not in an hour, but after a time period, it does. And I was taught that before I got up and spoke or shared that I was to get on my knees and ask God to move me out of the way, that I might help one person out there not have to do what I did. And, and I have a wonderful relationship with the God of my understanding today. And I hear people say a God of my misunderstanding, and I have a little understanding of God today, and I'm so excited about that. Alcoholics Anonymous gave me that. But sometimes my faith is not there, so, you know, you get on your knees and you ask him to help you, and then like 5 minutes later you want to get down to make sure he heard you, you know. So you have to say it again. And you know, so I'm trying not to do that now. It's like, okay, he heard you, Kathy. But anyway, and the basket in my room was absolutely wonderful. So, and I've enjoyed myself this weekend. I've enjoyed the speakers, and Joe, I enjoyed your talk. But he does love ladies. You can tell everywhere he goes. He's got like five ladies around him. And, you know, he spoke this weekend, and he's the only male and with the female speaker. So I know you're in your element. So, and I've just had a wonderful time this weekend. I brought a couple of girls with me from my area and a couple of girls I sponsor. And there and some girls that I know from Oklahoma showed up, and not just for me, they were here anyway, and they're all over on the front row, and that's the sick row right there, so so you know, I just want you to know where they are. But I've had an absolutely wonderful time getting to know my friend Mary Jo, and I've just really enjoyed talking and sharing with you, so thank you for sharing this weekend with me. And my sobriety date is April 28th of 2000. It's not my first, but I pray to God it's my last. I believe that if it come to the point again to where it was either kill myself or drink, I believe I'd be one of those people that blew my brains out before I drank. Alcohol beat me to a pulp. And I pray I never have to go through that pain again. You know, there's a lot of things in sobriety that you end up going through. You know, you get sober, you get a job, you start getting things, and you know, and other things just doesn't seem as important. You know, and those things and being somebody seems more important than other things. And I forget where I come from, and I get to that point to where. You know, to where I think that my ideas are great and that my program works and, you know, it's my program that got me here. And when I can get out of myself long enough to realize it's the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, that's the miracle and not me, you know, and that I can't do it alone and I need to work your program and not my program, it's a whole lot easier. You know, but when I don't do that, I get to the point to where I can't think, I can't sleep, I can't eat, I worry too much, I'm all up in everybody else's business, you know, and I want to drink again. And, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a relationship with the God of my understanding that is just beyond my wildest dreams. And I'm so grateful for that because I love what Alcoholics Anonymous has done to me and for me. You know, what stands before you today is nothing like what I used to be like. And I know that it's very easy for me to stop doing what I'm doing what I'm supposed to do in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and become selfish and self-centered to the extreme again, and to the point of picking up that drink. And I have to have a relationship with the God of my understanding. You know, Bill talks about, in the language of the heart, there's a story that's called emotional sobriety. And he talks a lot about having faulty emotional dependencies upon humans, upon Alcoholics Anonymous. And he talked about being in a depression until, you know, he found a way, which is the God of his understanding, that helped him get out of that. And I truly believe that, because no matter what goes on in my life, no matter if I go, you know, if I lose everything, death, everything that's happened to me in my life since I've been back to Alcoholics Anonymous, it's not a big deal. It's not a big deal. Drama and chaos all around me, but I'm shielded, you know, because of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous has changed me and morphed me into something that I never even thought possible. I've been rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence, you know, and I'm barely even here, if that makes any sense. I believe there's more than four dimensions. Bill talks about four, but, you know, it was like he was, what, 3 or 4 years sober when the book was published, you know, and I believe there's more than four. I think there may be 12, you know. There's 12 everything else. I've told you my sobriety date. My home group is the big town group in the little town of Etowah, North Carolina, in a little mountain town. We have two red lights, actually. I don't know why. There's not enough traffic there for two red lights, but it's a little bitty tiny town. And I absolutely love my home group. We have a closed big book study on Tuesday night at 7 p.m. We have an open speaker meeting, and we encourage people to bring their families to the open speaker meeting. And we have a closed step literature study on Sunday night, where in our big book study, in our step study, the chairperson reads the history behind what they read, either in the book or out of the, you know, with the step or whatever. They try to read the history about Alcoholics Anonymous and bring that to the group. Instead of trying to figure out what relates to it, they bring the history in. And I love the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. It just comes alive, makes the big book come alive for me. And so I just love our group, and we've just attracted people that's phenomenal, and our group has grown so much. And we've only been June will be 6 years that our group was started, and it's just phenomenal. In that little bitty tiny town that there's probably only 50 people in, you know, our home group, our speaker meeting gets about anywhere from 50 to 80 people on Friday night, and they just come, and I'm so grateful for that. I have a sponsor. Her name is Julie. And she has a sponsor, and she has a sponsor, and she's taken me through the steps out of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll just get into it. I was born July 7th, 1962. I'll be 50 years old this year, and I can't believe that. That's just phenomenal that I've even lived that long. I never thought I would live past 25, well, past 20, much less 25, you know, and I'm the second of eight kids. My mom and dad had five kids, and then mom and dad divorced, and my dad had remarried, and they have three kids. My youngest brother is 18, and my oldest sister is 50-something. You know, my dad drank. He drank Pabst Blue Ribbon and Jack Daniels. And, you know, growing up, I would steal his liquor out from under the cabinet, and I don't know how I knew to do this. You know, there was, in my home, it was not violent at all. My dad drank. My mom yelled a lot, but my dad drank, and when he didn't drink, he was very quiet and didn't have anything to do with anybody. And then when he would drink a little bit, he would be so funny and have something to do with us, and I absolutely loved my dad. I wanted to be just like him. You know, but from the earliest times I can remember, I never really felt like I fit in anywhere, just like you hear at the podium most of the time. You don't feel like you fit in. But I don't believe that I was equipped with life. I thought people were born with, like, a manual, you know, for directions on how to live life, and I had never got the manual. I learned how to lie early on. All of my isms started way before I ever picked up a drink. I was a chronic liar. I'd steal from you in a skinny minute. And I learned to con people. I would con my mom and dad to be able to get to do what I wanted to do. And I would pit them against each other. And they had many fights because of me going from one to the other. And I learned how to do the conniving really early. I don't remember my first drink. I know that I used to steal Daddy's drinks. And he kept the Jack Daniels up under the kitchen cabinet. And I would take sips of it and then fill it back up with water, and he would accuse Mama of watering his drinks down, you know. And then I would take those Pabst Blue Ribbon out of the back of the refrigerator. I'd poke a hole in it. I would suck the beer out and put the can back in the refrigerator, and Daddy thought he had defective cans. But I don't really remember the effects produced by alcohol until I was about 13 years old. I was very much a loner, didn't have very many friends. I didn't like school at all because I had to be around people. I just didn't like being around people. I loved being out in the woods, and I loved being alone, and I love being out in the woods today. Grew up country girl, and I absolutely love it. But, I totally forgot where I was going, y'all. That's menopause, I swear to God. But anyway, I would steal my dad's drink, and I'm 13, that's right. Never had any friends. I met this girl named Janet, and Janet was a loner too, and we got together. Her sister got married, and they had the wedding reception in one of those trailer parks, you know, one of those drunk trailer parks. And I'm in Georgia. Y'all know what a drunk trailer park is. I walked into the door of that trailer, and there were cases of Pabst Blue Ribbon in the corner, and we started drinking on that stuff, and that was the first time I ever felt the effects produced by alcohol. And I got sick that night, and I ended up passing out, but I absolutely loved what it did to me and for me. Absolutely. I didn't have to acquire the taste for it. I loved the taste of it. Always have. I love the smell, everything about it. I just absolutely loved it. And I've tried to clean this up the best I can, but, by the time I was 14, I was in the streets doing what I needed to do. And at 15, I was in a nut house because my family didn't know what to do with me. At 16, I was in a treatment center. And at 17, I was in a little juvenile prison for armed robbery. And, and I actually had a lot of fun out there, y'all. I really did, after I got out of that little juvenile prison, I found a place that's similar to what Joe was talking about. His was the limit and the paradise, I believe, and we had the county and the Long Branch, and they were across the street from each other. And when I walked into those places, I absolutely loved it. I fell in love with places like that. I used to call them bars, and I kind of followed in my dad's footsteps wherever he went, but I used to call them bars, and I was talking to him one day, and he said, "Honey, those aren't bars, those are beer joints. Bars are high class." These were the type places. They were cinder block. They had bars on the window, if they even had a window, bars on the front door. They had pickled pig's feet on the counter, and those deviled eggs, and, pickled pig's feet were really good when you were drinking. They went down pretty good, not so good coming back up. And that's what your diet consisted of. You walk in there and learn, playing pool, and the smell of urine and beer was just wonderful. And it was dark, so dark, and the laughter. I absolutely loved it, and that's where I stayed for a long time. In those places. But the county and the Long Branch was across the street from each other, and it was on this road that was way out in the country. It was on Dead Man's Curve. And I always wondered why they called it Dead Man's Curve. And I was thinking about it yesterday or Friday when Joe was talking, and it was because when we go across the street from one bar to another, somebody would end up getting hit and killed, drunk walking across the street. So that's why they called it Dead Man's Curve. But I absolutely love those places. By the time I was 18 years old, I was a daily drinker and I was a morning drinker. I was waking up with the shakes, or coming to with the shakes. And many times you wouldn't even go to sleep, you'd just stay up. They would lock you in South Carolina at midnight. It was, everything had to close down, so they would just lock 20 of us up in there, and we'd just be in there all night. And at 8 o'clock, you'd unlock the doors, and oh my God, it was like Vampireville or something when the light would shine. And I absolutely loved that. But by the time I was 18, I was a daily drinker, and I was shaking when I would come to, and I would have to have a hair of the dog that bit me. I was a beer drinker. I absolutely loved beer. So I hear some people say that they drank liquor because it was quicker or something, but I was a maintenance drinker. I had to have a beer in my hand at all times. And when I needed to get somewhere, that's when I drank liquor. But I always had to have the beer in my hand. And by the time I was 19, my drinking changed, where I was usually a happy-go-lucky drinker, not a cry-in-your-beer drink. I wasn't very violent or anything. But when I was 19, my drinking changed. And when I drank, I became very violent. And I was come to out of blackout, standing there with a knife in my hand and a guy laying on the ground. And I would walk in those places, and I would find the biggest, baddest guy I could find, and I would start a fight. I don't know why, but that's exactly what I did. And it was pretty violent from the time I was 19 up until I made it to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous the first time. I don't remember a whole lot. I was in constant blackout. I would come to in California and New York and Florida and wherever, and there are a lot of other things in my story that I don't talk about from the podium. I know that I'm not here to share a fifth step. I'm here to share with you how the progression of the disease was horrid for me. And I was not one that tiptoed into Alcoholics Anonymous after a drink of wine. And, I'm not here for social reasons. I'm not here because, I am here because alcohol about killed me. And this is the only place, the only thing that has ever worked for me. And I've tried so many things. Before I found Alcoholics Anonymous the first time, like I said, I don't remember drawing a sober breath. And I'm not going to stand up here and talk about the other things I did, because I respect Alcoholics Anonymous and our singleness of purpose. But I did everything there was to do in every way there was to do it. I drank so hard and so long, I absolutely loved it. And then it came to a point where I couldn't go without it. And I had no idea that that's what had happened to me in that time period where I was in a constant blackout. I'd be in a four-day blackout, be in Tennessee one day, and the next thing I know, I'm waking up in San Diego, California, and I have no idea how I got there. I can vaguely remember being on a Greyhound bus and getting caught for smoking something in the bathroom that I wasn't supposed to smoke in the bathroom. But that's about it. So the drinking was just horrid. The relationships with people were horrid. I would get into a relationship with somebody, and there's something about, how can I clean up? Something about drinking and my clothes didn't go together. And so I really couldn't have a relationship with anybody. I would pull you in, and I would get you in there, and then it would go away. And I never had a relationship with my family. I would be gone for 3 years at a time, and my mom never knew where I was at. I remember coming home one time when I was about 18 or 19 years old, and she hadn't seen me in forever, and I come pulling in, and she come running out of the house and punched me dead in the nose. She was going to identify a body the next day because she thought it was her daughter. And here I am doing what I need to do, and I'm not hurting anybody but me. And we hurt. Every time I picked up a drink, somebody paid the price. And usually it was those who were closest to me. At 27 years old, I found myself in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, with a stolen van. I don't know. Well, I kind of come to in a lot of places with something stolen, but this time it was different. I was shaking so violently when I came to, and that morning I thought about, what am I going to do? I'd never really heard about Alcoholics Anonymous. The only time I ever heard of AA is when Kate got sober on the Young and Restless, in that little treatment center I was in. I never, at 16, I didn't hear anything. All I heard was some long-haired guy named Charlie sticking his finger in my face, trying to pull some deep, dark secret out of me, and I never heard about, Alcoholics Anonymous. But that morning when I came to, I was thinking that if I, you know, if I just get off the streets, I can get 3 meals a day, you know, and get my GED, and maybe my mom and dad will have something to do with me. And I burnt my bridges a long time with anybody I'd ever been around. And so I decided to turn myself in, because I knew if I got off the streets, I really needed off the streets. And so I go walking into the Myrtle Beach police station, and I dangle these keys, and I say, "Here I am, I stole a van." And the lieutenant said, "Well, honey, there ain't nothing we can do for you." That's pretty bad when jail won't even take you. Took me many times when I didn't want to go, you know. And I broke down crying, and I told her I thought I might have a problem. And I didn't know that it was alcohol that was my problem. I said, if I go out there, I don't know what's going to happen to me. I always thought that when people thought of, you know, suicide, that it was weakness. You know, you'd never catch me thinking about suicide, you know. I'm that tough exterior. And so I never really thought about that. But I was crying that day, and I knew if I walked out that door that something was going to happen to me that I didn't want happen. And, you know, and she said, and as I turned around, she said, "Wait a minute, honey, I might know somebody that can help you." And she called this little guy named Roy McCormick, and Roy McCormick's in the sky, and, you know, he's at the big meeting now, and I absolutely love Roy, and I thank God for people like him. He had 28 years of sobriety, and they didn't have meetings in that jail, but he would call the jail, and he would go visit them and tell them if they had anybody that maybe needed help, that he was there. And thank God for that, you know, because if it hadn't have been for him unselfishly giving of himself like that, I may not be standing here today. And she called Roy, and she said, "Go stand out there by the payphone. He's going to call you back." And I went out by the payphone, and Roy told me to meet him somewhere, and I met him at the Kettle with a stolen van. And you know, and he walked in, and I tell you, I always thought my knight in shining armor was going to be somebody like The Rock or Triple H, you know. And my knight in shining armor was a little old man that stood about this tall that had tears coming down of his eyes because he had glaucoma, and he smoked a fake cigar, and he had a hat on that said The Dollhouse, and I don't know if y'all know what The Dollhouse is, but... You know, and he touched me on the shoulder, and he said, "Here, honey, I'm recruiting for The Dollhouse. Would you like to apply?" And The Dollhouse is a strip joint. You know, and I just broke down crying. He said, "Honey, it's okay. I'm here. I'm with Alcoholics Anonymous. I was just kidding, you know." And he took me to my first meeting, and it was the primary purpose group in Myrtle Beach, and I'll never forget it. The men sit on one side, and the women sit on the other, and, of course, I had to sit on the men's side. I don't want nothing to do with the women. And, you know, I don't remember a whole lot about that meeting. I remember when they gave out the chips, it made me think of that thing, you know, 2 bits, 4 bits, 6 bits, $1 or something, and nobody got a chip, and I was like, wow, okay. But that's about, and I remember one woman talking about all the things that she had done, and that she wasn't, morally bad. She was spiritually sick, because all my life I thought I was morally bad. I really had no clue that I was a sick person. I just thought I was bad, and you know, I remember that. And those women gave me their phone numbers, and they took me in, and I'll be forever grateful for that home group for teaching me the basics of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is about our traditions, you know, and about the unity of Alcoholics Anonymous, and about that one drunk walking in the door, and, you know, and about that woman walking in the door thinking she's the only one that done the thing she done, and all she needs is love. And I'm so grateful for the men in that group that left me alone long enough. Well... Actually, the man I got entangled with was not in that group. But, you know, the men in that group showed me what it was like to have a relationship with a man without anything attached or anything expected, and I'm so grateful for that. They taught me about the love of the home group, about being there when I'm supposed to be there, you know, about the only time I don't get there is when I've got a fever and contagious, when I'm in the hospital or when I'm out of town or if I'm dead, then you don't go to your home group. But and the responsibility behind being in a home group. I absolutely love, there's a big difference between a home group. A meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is where you go, you walk in, you know, maybe 10 minutes till, you might say, hey, you get a cup of coffee and you sit down. and then you just leave. You don't help clean up. You don't know anybody, really anything about anybody's life. But a home group is somewhere where you go, and those you get to know those people, and you're there early, and you stay late, and you help. We used to clean up ashtrays, but you don't do that now. But you help. You know, you become involved, and those people become involved in your life, and they know what's going on with you when you walk in that door, and they see that look on your face, and they say, "What's wrong?" And you say, "Oh, I'm fine." And I said, "No, you're not, Kathy. What's wrong?" And I'm so grateful for a home group, and that I was taught the difference. That home, that group taught me about the love of the old timer. You know, and I'm so grateful for the old timers, and I was taught that old timer has 30 years or more. And, you know, and I love that. When we moved to the area that we're in, and we were wondering where the old-timers were. We couldn't find them. They weren't anywhere around, you know. And finally, you know, realized that a lot of them can't even drive anymore. They can't see to drive at night, you know, and they need help. So if you're wondering where your old-timers are, if you ain't seen them in a while, pick up the phone and call them. Ask them if they need a ride. Show up at their house, knock on the door, and say, "Come on, we're going to a meeting." You know, and if they say, "No, nah, that's okay," tell them to shut up and get in the car, because that's what they told us. You know, we need our old timers, and I'm so grateful for the people who have stuck around, and for the people, and I don't mean somebody that's sitting there with 30 years of sobriety is miserable. I'm talking about the men in my life, like the Tom Eyes, who has 54 years of sobriety and is more active than anybody I know in Alcoholics Anonymous. Like Dave C., you know, with 54 years of sobriety, that is more active than anybody I know in Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to be like that. I aspire to be like that. I can't sit back on my laurels and let everybody else do the work. I got to be right in there with you. I'm so grateful for good sponsorship. Let me get on with this, and we'll talk about that later. But, you know, so I got in the middle of this home group, and they taught me about service work, and I started sponsoring women, and I ended up going back to school. I made a mistake of telling my sponsor what I wanted to be. I always wanted to be Florence Nightingale. I'd sit under a magnolia tree and read Florence Nightingale when I was young, and I always wanted to be Florence Nightingale. And she pushed me to go back to school, and I dropped out of school, like, in the, made it to like the ninth grade. I don't even know where I made it to in school. I just dropped out. And she pushed me to go back to school. I got my GED, and it took me 4 years to get a two-year degree, but I got my RN, and I'm a registered nurse today, and I'm so grateful that she pushed me to do that. But lots of things happened to me. I met a guy. Actually, he was in my first meeting that I met, and I ended up marrying him. He's actually my second husband. I won't talk about my first, but I don't remember it too much. Kind of woke up with him, married, and don't remember too much about it. But, you know, I'm Shannon and I got together, and we ended up getting married, and I watched money take a man. You know, we started, it's like I was talking about, we come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and we get all this stuff, and we forget what's important. And sitting there watching him, you know, he would go out and go to work and bring in $26,000 at one time. And it became Alcoholics Anonymous came second. And I watched money take a man, where it became more important to make that money than it was to do what he needed to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And after 5 years, he ended up going back out. And we ended up in divorce. He ended up in prison, and I'm not exactly sure where he is now, but he was a good man. But I should have never married him. He was like my brother. I was so sick when I come in here, and I just have no idea what I want and what I need. You know, as I think most of us do, we think we know what we want, but it's usually what our bodies want and not what we need. After I got my nursing degree, I decided I wanted to do some travel nursing, and I started doing travel nursing. Travel nursing is where you do a phone interview, and they review your application, and you go somewhere for 3 to 6 months at a time, and I started doing that at 7 years of sobriety. I was in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm talking about in the middle. I was sponsoring women. I was doing service work. I'd been every officer in our group, you know, every position, and And I decided to do this travel nursing. And when I went out of town, my first job was in Belleville, New Jersey. Oh, my God, that's the armpit of America. And I would go to meetings. And at first, I started sticking my hands out, you know, and introducing myself and trying to find the meetings and my people. And then it got to where I wasn't sticking my hand out. I was going to a meeting, and I was sitting in the back row, and I was getting there late and leaving early. And I really didn't get to know anybody. My 6 meetings a week went to 5. My 5 meetings a week went to 4. My 4 went to 3. My 3 went to 2. And then my 2 went to 1 every now and then. And I don't know about you, but when I don't go to Alcoholics Anonymous on a regular basis, I don't feel like I fit in. And this is the only place I've ever felt like I fit in. And I ended up in San Diego, California, not going to meetings on a regular basis, close to 9 years of sobriety or close to 9 years dry. Got viral meningitis, and an infection of the covering of the brain, and I actually thought I was going to die. It was the most horrible experience that I've ever had. I lost from 130 pounds down to 80 pounds, 88 pounds of nothing, and I looked like a skeleton. And I was so sick. I couldn't even get out of the bed for a month. And I would lay there, and I would think, that's so dangerous when you don't go to meetings, thinking, you know, here I am so sick. My family's 3,000 miles away from me, and where's Alcoholics Anonymous? This is how my disease talks to me. You know, I'm not even in touch with anybody. Nobody knows what's going on with me. I haven't availed myself of anybody, so I don't have anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's where they were. I thought they just didn't care. Well, I don't need AA. Me and God's got it. You know, without Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't have God. I really don't. It wasn't long, but when I started getting better, these travel nurses come and took care of me 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And after I got better, after 2 months being really, really sick, I felt obligated to these travel nurses, and I became their designated driver. And we were going to the bars and hooping and hollering, and they were drinking and hooping and hollering and having fun, and I'm sitting at the bar drinking my Diet Coke, not fitting in. Because when I'm out there and I'm not drinking, I don't fit in out there either. You know, and so it wasn't long before those near beers started looking good to me. You know, the old Duels and the Shard, the non-alcoholic beer for non-alcoholics. It has 0.5% alcohol by volume. Drinking 6 of those is like having a Budweiser. And I don't know about y'all, but when I drink, I don't want to feel that ding. I want to feel that bam. And I had put that back in my body again. That physical craving set into me. And from July until October, I was drinking so much of that stuff. I mean, I was drinking a 12-pack before noon. That's the hardest drinking I ever did in my life. God, it was hard drinking. And it came to a point where I was talking to earlier that my life was just going down the tubes. I started to do it even before I picked up that old Duels. Things were going down the tube way before then. I started, you know, I stopped going to meetings. I stopped praying. I was being very dishonest, stealing from where I was working. I was just doing a lot of things and all that. And that's why I love Step 1 when it talks about, sometimes I think that should be 2 steps. You know, yeah, I admitted I was powerless over alcohol. I had no misconceptions about what I was or what was going to happen to me. Had no misconceptions. But there's a hyphen, and a hyphen means stop, a separate thought's coming, that our lives have become unmanageable. You know, and my life was way unmanageable before I ever picked up that drink of alcohol. And it came to the point where I was ready to kill myself or take a drink, and I picked up a drink October 31st in 1998. There was no romancing. It was straight back to the blackouts. My sobriety car became my drunk car, and it was horrendous. Horrendous. It's a wonder that, you know, here I am at this time period. I'm working in a trauma unit, and I'm taking care of 12-year-old kids who have been hit by drunk drivers. And I'm hardly able to work because I'm just so drunk, hungover from the day before, coming out of blackouts, taking care of people. And I was working in CVICU taking care of open heart patients, and that's who was taking care of you when you were sick. I don't know how they didn't know. I really don't. I don't know if I killed anybody in that time period. I decided after that, it was October of 98 when I picked up that drink. August of 1999, I thought I wanted to come home because I thought if I went home that maybe around my family I might be able to get sober. So I moved to Charlotte, North Carolina, Belmont, right outside of Charlotte. And I moved in with my sister and her two boys and her husband, and all I did was bring trash in her home. I would go to meetings and I would try, and I would walk in there and I would see people, and somebody would say hey to me, and I would just run. I never really stuck my hand out and asked for help. And I have so many white chips because I'd walk into a meeting and I wanted to be there. I wanted to be there more than anything. And I hate when I hear people say, Alcoholics Anonymous is not for those who need it, it's for those who want it. Because I wanted it and I needed it, and I could not put the plug in the jug. I could not put it down. I would walk in a meeting, I want to be there, and 15 minutes after I was there, I knew I was going to take a drink, and I would force myself to pick up a white chip, hoping against hope that I wouldn't drink. And I would walk out of that meeting, and the first place I would hit was be a bar. And I could not put it down, no matter how bad I wanted to. That physical craving was so great. I would come to with the most horrendous hangover I've ever had in my entire life. And I would have to drink, not wanting to. So I understand what it is about drinking against your will. Because I had to drink. I had to get rid of that. And I finally moved out in November of 99. Moved out of my little sister's house because I needed to drink the way I needed to drink. And I moved in what I call my little two-bedroom tomb. And it was a little tiny trailer on the lake, a mile away from anybody. And I basically locked myself up in there and drank. I don't remember a whole lot about that from November of 99 to April of 2000. I remember, all I know is I would come to in the living room and there'd be vodka bottles and Pabst Blue Ribbon all around. And I don't even know how I got it. And no signs of anybody else. I became what I used to call an old lady closet drinker. I remember the first time I was in here, I wanted to get a sponsor. I didn't want an old lady closet drinker. I wanted somebody to drink like I did so she would know, you know. That's exactly what I became. And April, on a Tuesday, my little sister called me and asked me if I wanted to go to a wrestling match. And I said, yeah, I love wrestling. My family grew up with wrestling. And yes, we know it's fake. And if you didn't, I didn't mean to bust your bubble. I don't remember going. I don't remember coming home. I called my little sister on Wednesday, and she was very short with me. Yes, no, bye. And the next day, I went to her house. That was on Thursday. I went to her house, and I walked in her house, and she looked at me with that look I thought I'd never see on her face, because no matter what, my little sister loved me unconditionally. And when everybody was out of my life, my little sister was there for me. And when I walked in that house and I seen that look on her face, and she said, Kathy, I love you, but I can't stand to watch you kill yourself. I don't want you around me. I don't want you around my husband. And I don't want you around my boys. And she basically kicked me out of her life. You know, when I went home and I drank and I drank and I drank, and my body was drunk, but my mind wasn't. I couldn't shut it off. I ended up passing out. The next day was April 28th. I came to. And I was as cold as I'd ever been on the inside. And when I decided that I would try to find a meeting, and the only thought I could have in my mind was that some of us have to die so that others can live. And I heard that so many times in Alcoholics Anonymous. Some of us have to die so that others can live, and I thought that was going to be me. Because I knew Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't going to work for me anymore. So I called and I found that meeting at 7:30. I didn't drink. I pulled in, and by this time I had so much fear. I carried a 45 around with me all the time, locked and cocked. It's the only way you carry a 45, though. But and that's what I went to that meeting, and I pulled in the parking lot about 7:30, and I looked around, and it looked like there were 200 people, but they might have been 30, you know. And the thought was in my head, some of us have to die so that others can live. And I picked up that 45. And I put it to my head. And as I feel that cold steel against my temple, as I'm unlocking it, I hear a voice in my head that said, try it one more time. And people say that God don't speak to you, but God spoke to me that night. And I put that gun down under the seat, and I walked into that meeting. I'll be forever grateful for a little old lady named Dorothy, you know, who said, welcome home, honey. So if you're coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous, welcome home. If you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, relapse is not a part of recovery. It does not have to be. You know, and you don't have to go back out to get what I got. You can stay right here. You know, she didn't say, do you think you want to make it this time? I'm so grateful for that. The guy who got up and gave the chips out, I'm so grateful that he didn't say, well, if you've been out there barking at a tree, come and get this white chip. Or he didn't say, if you're sitting in a blackout. You know, it's humiliating enough, and it's so hard to get up and get that. My God, let them have a little bit of dignity and say, this is the desire to stop drinking chip and leave it. You know, I wasn't out there trying to improve my story. I was out there dying. And I didn't have to have somebody to tell me to get a sponsor. I knew that. I didn't have to have anybody tell me to get a home group. I didn't have to tell anybody to tell me that I needed to work the steps. I knew exactly what I needed to do. I had the foundation of Alcoholics Anonymous for my sobriety before. Alcohol, and I hear people say something like, you need to forget about that 9 years that you had. You know, AA didn't, you know, it didn't work. And I'm here to tell you that Alcoholics Anonymous always worked. It was me who didn't work Alcoholics Anonymous. AA always works. And I got busy. You know, I laid and shook in my bed for 2 weeks, and I vomited, and I puked, I pooped myself, and I seen spiders on the wall, and I would clean myself up at night, and I would get to a meeting, and I would go home because I knew it wasn't between me and you. I need you. I need people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I need Alcoholics Anonymous, but my sobriety is dependent upon my God, the God of my understanding, and I'm so grateful to know that today. I'm not the same person that walked in Alcoholics Anonymous. Those steps have changed my life. This program saved my life. You know, I used to work in the ER, and I would absolutely love to get them little old ladies who would come in with a heart attack, and they would say, you know, oh, God's testing my faith. And I'm like, no, God didn't throw that KFC down your throat to clot your arteries to test your faith. You know, my God is a God of love. There is nothing else to explain it. You know, I don't try to put a definition to the God of my understanding. It's the love that I found in the room of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and it's conditional on the maintenance, on how I maintain. People talk about step 10 being, or step 10, 11, 12 being maintenance steps. You know, in my life, they're not maintenance steps. I don't want them to be maintenance steps. I want them to be living steps. Because when you maintain something, if you think about it, you maintain a yard. You know, and what does a yard look like? It looks, you know, the same, basically. You can plant a flower here and there, you know, but it basically looks the same. It's maintained. You know, the steps have worked in my life on a daily basis, and I am no saint, and I don't even pretend to be. I have lots of character defects and lots of things that go on in my life. But because of two men who knew exactly, who didn't know exactly what they were doing, but God knew what He was doing when He gave us the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'm married to a guy, and I'm going to, in this scene, I'm married to a guy named Mike. I absolutely adore my husband. On May 4th, we'll be married 11 years, and we've never had an argument. Never. And I don't need to hear about it after the meeting, how unhealthy that is. He has 19 years of sobriety, and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is more active than, he's just as active as the old timers that I know in my life, and I'm so grateful for that. Our home is an AA home, and And he lives the steps, and I'm so grateful for him in my life. I don't ride on his coattail, and he don't ride on mine, you know, and I'm so grateful for that. But I absolutely, we were at a conference right after we had gotten married, and we were talking, it was maybe 6 months after we had gotten married, and this woman come up, you know, was standing at the tape table because my husband's a taper, and she was standing at the tape table, and she heard us talking about not having an argument, and she goes, just wait. Just wait. It's unhealthy to not have arguments, you know. Just wait. So the next year she comes back up to me when we're there again, and she said, so tell me about it. I said, tell you about what? She said, well, tell me about your arguments. How was it? And I said, well, when we have one, I'll tell you. And she goes, that's unhealthy, unhealthy. It's just unhealthy. And walks away, mad. She was very upset. The next year, I walked up to her, and I tapped her on the shoulder, and I said, we still haven't had an argument. And she goes, that's unhealthy, just unhealthy. I know. I've been married 7 times. And which is something I'm so grateful that my sponsor, Marianelle, gave me things, little pearls of wisdom. It's like, you know, if you're having problems with your relationship, don't go to somebody who's in the middle of a divorce. Don't go to somebody who is does not have a successful relationship. Go to somebody who's having a successful relationship. When Mary Nell and I got together and I went to her house, and one of the first times that we talked, I was telling her I had some financial issues. She said, you got what? And I said, I've got some financial issues. She said, honey, you don't have issues. Issues are what Capitol Hill has. You have character defects. It's called irresponsibility. Put a name on it. And she does. She never allows me to use the word issues because it's a blanket. You know, she wanted me to get down to the causes and conditions, which is what our book tells us to do. She also said, I don't ever want to hear you say you do that because you're an alcoholic. It's just an excuse to continue bad behavior. And I'm so grateful that she would never let, she never sugarcoated anything for me. That woman loved me. In 2005, she passed away unexpectedly, you know, and because of what she taught me, my world did not crumble. It did not crumble. I miss her. Yeah. I miss everything about her. You know, but God put another woman that was similar to Mary Nell in my life that gives me what I need with a firm and loving hand. And I'm so grateful for that because my best thinking and my program got me to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new to AA, stay. You don't have to go. Come in. Sit down and rest a while. You know, if you've been around Alcoholics Anonymous for a while, you're sitting there with a few years and you're wondering if this is all there is. No, it's not. Grab somebody. You don't have to go back out. You know, grab a hold of somebody. Get in the middle of the book. Grab another human being. Our book tells us nothing will so much ensure immunity as practical experience. I can't quote the book, okay? Practical experience shows that nothing will ensure immunity from, as if you work with another alcoholic. And that's been true in my life. No matter what's going on in my life, to take the time for that drunk. We lost our cabin and we're still paying on a cabin that we haven't lived in a long time. You know, they foreclosed on our house when everything went downhill and I decided to take a position as a hospice nurse. And we don't make any money, nowhere near what they make in the hospital, and I absolutely love what I do. You know, I thought when I got into nursing that I would be holding a hand and saving a life. You know, and today I get to hold a hand while life's slipping away. And what an honor to walk in somebody's life so deeply. And it's what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. We hold the hand of somebody who's dying. And we help them through God using us as an instrument. And the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, we help them come back to life. We help them to come from that world to this world. And that's what hospice does. We help them go from this world to that world. And I think in those two areas, Alcoholics Anonymous and what I do meet. Because all my life I have took and I have took and I have took. And today I get to give. And for that, I thank God and Alcoholics Anonymous. I love y'all. Thanks.